from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, on the road, filming. Today, we're going to engage in commentaries. I'll be sharing my own commentaries that I've written, plus I'm going to take a look at how money is destroying the world through addiction. Also, how the media whitewashes the Gaza massacre. Joe Loria, a special to Consortium News. And also, our passive society. Why we will not become proactive, even in the interest of self-preservation and protecting our freedoms and our health and our children's health. Chris Wright, Counterpunch. And also the coming climate famine. Yeah, that's what they're calling it here. Coming famine anarchy. Dr. Glenn Berry from Echo Internet. These are really heavy hitters looking at topics that we're not covering in the mainstream media. And of course, we'll have some audio clips, and I've selected a variety. We're going to, for example, hear, why would anyone choose to defend the character of people who, with malice aforethought, go out to harm, kill, and degrade human beings on a regular basis? Why would we be so politically correct to say, well, they're human beings, are they acting like a human being? And what would it be if the people in the mainstream media, like the people on MSNBC, what if they were attacked, or a friend or family member was attacked and hacked to death with 60 knives left in their body and the people laughing about doing it? How would your perception of that person be at that point? I just believe that we have lost our sense of moral bearing when it comes to being able to be honest about the world we're living in. And identity politics is a scourge, and there's going to be a big pushback against it in the upcoming times because we've had enough of this. Except here's the danger. Those who have access to the media, to a radio form, to a newspaper column, to an article in a magazine, to a television position, don't get so caught up in yourself and your own ego because you have a small, infinitesimal audience. Remember, even the number one show on MSNBC has less than 1% of the population watching them. It's like 0.5%. And yet they would think that they're far more significant. What about all the other people? Because they're not buying your nonsense. So we're going to talk about that. We're also going to take a look at three sickening ways that America is criminalizing being poor. We're also going to ask people, turn off your router at night. Why? You'll see how dangerous that internet router is, and everybody's got them. Also, let's leave it to George Carlin to talk about the American dream. So that's our show today. We have a lot to share. And you can always listen to us live every day, Monday to Friday, noon to 1, by calling this number. I suggest you write it down. You never know when you might need it. 424-203-8046. 424-203-8046. But the reality is 98% of the people listening to this program are listening to it not live, but in their convenient times, generally in the evening. It's the archive number. Let me give you that number, because anywhere where you have a cell phone, anywhere where you have ability to call even on your laptop, anywhere in the world, here's the number you want to call. 701-719-9976. 701-719-9976. And before we begin, I just want to say thank you for going to prn.fm. the homepage, looking at all of the articles that we're posting. Our next will be this coming Monday with a major one-hour special on, I'm not going to tell you the topic, but it's one that impacts everyone, and Wikipedia saying it doesn't work, and we providing an enormous amount of qualified evidence that it does. So at a certain point, there will be a shift. When that will happen, I cannot tell you. Maybe when we do our 20th or 100th report on the so-called experts are wrong about everything that they're supposed to be an expert on when it comes to reporting on Wikipedia. So we're just going to keep hammering away quality scholarship. And we always do our research as if what we're going to print or say can be used in a court of law. That's the standard we reach, far above anything else out there in the media or in scientific journals. I challenge the Journal of the American Medical Association. I challenge the Lancet British Medical Journal to meet our standard of scholarship. You can't. You haven't. You are an embarrassment. We are setting a new standard. Try following us. I can show you where half your articles, peer-reviewed, are wrong. I can show you who's funding those articles, which should immediately disqualify them because of the financial bias. You still allow them to be published. I can show you ghostwritten articles where the author never even saw the material. They were paid to have their name from a prestigious institution to give the article some pedigree of credibility when there is none from ghostwritten. So we're going to turn this whole issue upside down, and we're doing it now. So every time you go to there and you read an article, you watch a film, share it. By the way, it's not by accident. With no interviews, I refuse interviews, no interviews, no advertising, no publicity, the Progressive Radio Network is still number one in the entire world, dwarfing anything else on any of the other stations because they got stuck into ideology, they got stuck into narcissism, they got stuck into these stupid ideas of identity politics, and they forgot about one simple thing, the audience. They have no audience. We do, and I want to thank the millions of people who are out there, and we're going just to be flooding you with more information than you've ever seen coming out on first Wikipedia. Sooner or later, Jimmy Wells will pay attention. Maybe not now, but I promise you, in time. Because we're going to give you the truth about health and why the people who claim to be the ultimate arbiters of health are clueless about health. Let's begin, and I'll show you how it works. University of Wisconsin did a study about how you can train yourself to be compassionate. In effect, they're talking about boosting your brain's resilience to other suffering. Now, that's a very unique and original concept because let's just be realistic. It can be distressing to witness the pain of family and friends or even strangers going through a hard time. And that's why I post so many on my personal Facebook every day. If I can find a human interest story that can be motivating or inspiring, I always post them. Because we always have a certain place in our hearts that we cannot hide, that forces us to feel deeply when we see someone else suffering who shouldn't. And therefore, training ourselves to be more compassionate and calm in the face of other suffering. So that's the question behind research from the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And a new study suggests that as little as 2 weeks of compassion meditation training, intentionally cultivating positive wishes to understand and relieve the suffering of others, may reduce the distress a person feels when witnessing another suffering. It can also improve their ability and likelihood to respond with compassion, and therefore try to help a person. And this was published in the current issue of Frontiers in Psychology, peer-reviewed journal. So think of all the times you've walked by someone and you see that they are homeless or hungry, and you keep walking. You think, well, I'm just one person, and there's a lot of homeless people. How can I help? It's not important how many you can't help. So just start realigning your perspective. If you just help that one person, you've made a difference to that one person. But you also have made a difference in the construct of your argument, I can't do anything. You just did. You just did. So let us start training ourselves. When we see something is wrong, let's stop and address it wherever possible. A nutrient that I recommend is pomegranate. Well, it's a food, but in it are all these nutrients. And nutrients then become our body, our cells, our DNA. The fruits are very good at repairing damaged DNA, and the greens are very good at cleansing, purifying, getting rid of heavy metals and toxins out of the body. The Indian Institute of Technology, Curtin University in Australia, Dong Duc Tang University in Vietnam, the National University of Singapore, published an article in the Journal of Pharmacological Research, a major journal. Let me read the abstract. This is very timely. In fact, prophetically timely. I'm quoting directly from the abstract. Quote, the intake of fruits have proven to reduce the risk and incidence of cancer worldwide and plays a crucial role in cancer prevention. Pomegranate, which belongs in a particular family, is one such plant that contains beneficial nutrients as well as many bioactive components and important phytochemicals that can be attributed to cancer-related therapeutic purposes. Pomegranate possesses antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, and anti-proliferative, and anti-angiogenic, and anti-invasive, and anti-metastatic properties, and induces programmed cell death, meaning it speeds up the cancer cell dying. It also downregulates various signaling pathways such as NFKB, P13K, AKT, MTOR, and WNT, and downregulates the expression of genes that are responsible in cancer development, such as anti-apoptotic genes, MMP, VEGF, cyclins, and pro-inflammatory cytokines. Therefore, inclusion of the fruit in one's diet would assist in a healthy life protected from cancer and also an effective chemotherapeutic with no toxic side effects. End quote. How about that? Mainstream universities, multiple ones, major publication showing that those fruits, one fruit, pomegranate, made a major impact in protecting cancer patients and helping cancer patients and preventing cancer. So now think of those skeptics, those science-based medicine, reductionist, orthodox, linear-brained, ultra-conservative thinkers who, in my personal opinion, wouldn't know real science if they saw it. This is orthodox proprietary science. This is science-based medicine. The ones that make drugs instead of using the fruit that the drug is made from. How about that? That ties into what we did recently and which is now published online and up on. And by the way, it was today, it was all over the world in different publications. So word's getting out. Get the article, send it to everyone you know. So plant-based medicines and the Wikipedia science and how they say none of this works, these plants, and we're showing it does work. From the University of Milano, which is in Italy, a groundbreaking research shows that neurological health depends as much on signals sent by the body's large leg muscles to the brain as it does on directives from the brain to the muscles. This is published in the Frontiers in Neuroscience. The study fundamentally alters brain and nervous system medicine, giving doctors new clues as to why patients with motor neuron disease, there's your multiple sclerosis, or spinal muscular atrophy and other neurological diseases, often rapidly decline when their movement becomes limited. quote, "Our study supports the notion that people who are unable to do load-bearing exercises, such as patients who are bedridden, or even astronauts, or people in extended travel, not only lose muscle mass, but their body chemistry is altered at the cellular level, and even their nervous system is adversely impacted." End quote. So, not now, but in the next 2 weeks, you're going to hear, unrehearsed, uncoached, I'll hear from them when you hear from them live on the air, individuals who all had neurological problems. And they were given a protocol, very simple one, uncomplicated. The results, you simply will not believe it. I'm not going to say anything more than that. They're all at their physicians now in hospitals getting follow-up medical reports. When we have those medical reports and it's confirmed, then I'll have them on as guests. And then let those who do not believe in energy say that it can't be done, because what was done was as significant as Bannister breaking the four-minute mile, even more so. How about that? You'll hear more and hear the whole story in about a week to 10 days. This is from PreventDisease.com. Once again, I'm going to go back to the idea that how many times would people be on a healthier diet, maybe even saving their lives or lessening pain or lessening suffering or preventing a condition, if when they went to Wikipedia, that I don't recommend anyone go to any longer or support on any level, and they looked up botanicals because someone told them, hey, I use curcumin or I use ginkgo and it worked. And there they say very clearly and unequivocally, none of this stuff works. You know, it's all garbage. So what about the moral responsibility for someone who then intentionally tries to prevent people from trying something that indeed science has shown, real science has shown, would help them? Should they be held morally responsible? Here's the latest, and again, this is very timely. I'll quote this. Quote, "Some phytochemicals and botanicals have very promising evidence of combating cognitive decline, according to a new systematic review of children. Researchers from Poland and Italy looked at studies published in the English language from 1970 to 2017, that explored how botanical ingredients and phytochemicals may affect cognitive declines. Quote, as it emerges from this systematic review, the use of some phytochemicals and botanicals seem to be very promising in order to delay the onset and progression of neurodegenerative and other age-related diseases. End quote. This was published in the last issue of Pharmacological Research. So, A, we got a major journal telling you what this enormous study, 47 years study, showed. So the goal was to summarize and comment on the available evidence supporting the use of some botanicals and phytochemicals in clinical practice. This means doctors, nurses, dentists, nutritionists, dietitians, those who are licensed and qualified to counsel someone. Here's what it says, quote, looking at randomized clinical trials and meta-analysis, the researchers used two databases, Medline, that's the government's official, if it's in Medline, then the government supports that it should be there. It's met the guidelines for quality, as well as the Cochrane Register of Controlled Trials, to collect reports for 47 years. They use words such as botanicals, dietary supplements, herbs, nutraceuticals, phytochemicals, cognitive impairment, Alzheimer's, to narrow down the results. Quote, a number of studies have investigated the possible actions on cognitive decline of different botanicals and phytochemicals, most of which are well-known anti-inflammatory and antioxidant agents with a good safety profile, they wrote, end quote. The search focused on seven botanicals, and phytochemicals that have a body of science demonstrating activity on the central nervous system and other clinical relevant effects in modulating cognitive decline in humans. They looked at ginkgo biloba, vitis, and camellia, and theobroma cacao, which is chocolate, and curcuma, which is curcumin, and a couple others. Here's what they say. Mind you, this is a 47-year review in peer-reviewed literature of these trials. Quote, the researchers found that most of the randomized controlled trials available use the EGB-761 ginkgo biloba extract. Quote, ginkgo biloba is one of the most widely used natural compounds for the prevention and treatment of Alzheimer's disease, they reported. They cited a meta-analysis of 21 clinical trials by researchers which reported that ginkgo biloba supplementation in combination with conventional medicine was superior to conventional medicine alone in improving mild cognitive impairment scores. 11 studies on ginkgo biloba total were cited for their database research. They concluded that ginkgo biloba, quote, is potentially beneficial for the improvement of cognitive function, daily life activities, and global clinical assessment in patients who have just suffered from mild cognitive impairment, end quote. How about that? And then resveratrol, that's another one, that's your vitis. Now, most studies analyzed by the researchers used the trans-isomer resveratrol found naturally in berry skins, like grape skins. They cited 34 studies that looked at resveratrol's potential cognitive benefits, meaning helping the brain, helping your memory, helping cognition. Quote, this is from the study. Cognitive deficits were demonstrated to correlate with higher reactive oxygen, that's your oxidative stress, by the way, levels, and nitrogen species. In effect, the oxidative stress seems to precede the senile plaque formation. I'll explain that in a moment, what that means. In this regard, resveratrol extract exerts potential antioxidant activity that could be useful in preventing neurodegeneration in Alzheimer's disease. That's them saying it, not me. So there you have it. They're saying that, yes, resveratrol helps with cognition, and yes, ginkgo biloba helps with cognition. Mind you, there are thousands and thousands of more studies dealing with cancer and heart disease and helping your arteries and cleaning and healing your arteries. They're only dealing with cognition. So think of how many people could be benefited. How about probably one-third of the entire American adult population? One-third. You're dealing with almost 100 million people right there or more. More than 100 million. So think of all the people who would have better memory, better cognition, better spatial values, being able to walk into a room and realize why they're there, to read something and remember it, to have a conversation and remember it, to go through daily rituals and understand what they're doing and why, and better able to be a part of their family and take care of themselves. So this is not of little consequence when this information is withheld from us or denigrated. There's an enormous moral implementing factor here that if you choose to withhold information from people that has been proven by independent science to work, then you're morally responsible. But then again, you're assuming that someone who is that anal and that strict, in my opinion, would have an understanding of anything moral in the way of science to begin with. But they're saying it there, and then they go into cacao and its potential. Quote, in recent years, a great attention has been given to the potential positive cognitive effects of flavanols contained in cacao, and that the research suggests that cacao flavonoids affect both endothelial vascular function and insulin sensitivity through mechanisms involved with nitrous oxide. That's good. Quote, short-term interventions with flavanol-rich cacao in elderly volunteers reported improvements in cerebral blood flow, improvements in neurovascular coupling, they wrote. And this was published in the British Journal of Clinical Pharmacology. So, there's your chocolate. Doing good for the brain. Improving arterial cerebral blood flow, that's a big deal. So I'm leaving it at that just to show you that once again, those of you who've been using those supplements, you're on the right side of history and the right side of health and the right side of helping your whole body. And finally, today, there has been a new study from Brighton and Sussex Medical Schools in the United Kingdom showing medication-related harm in older adults is common, costly, and preventable. Quote, new research indicates that harm from medicines is common in older adults following hospital discharge, and it results in substantial use of healthcare resources. And this was published in the British Journal of Clinical Pharmacology. And it's 1 in 3 older adults following hospital discharge ends up harmed. Wow. And yet that doesn't get any attention. So not talking about what doesn't work in medicine and denying what does work that's natural and non-toxic. And then you begin to see the divide, the chasm between these. Well, finally, from Louisiana State University, eat early, fast, late in day to improve blood sugar control and blood pressure. Now, this is a study conducted at Louisiana State University, the Biomedical Research Center, that shows that eating all your meals by mid-afternoon and fasting the rest of the day improves blood sugar and blood pressure and oxidative stress, even when people don't change what they eat. Quote, ours is the first study in humans that shows consuming all your calories in a 6-hour period provides metabolic advantages compared to eating the exact same amount over 12 hours or more. And that's why, by the way, I've told the people I counsel, your most important meal is your breakfast. That's where you put in all your berries and your plant-based proteins and your essential fatty acids. And then one more meal in the early afternoon. And that's it. Then you want to graze, have an apple, have something simple, but no more meals. And you do your body an enormous amount of good. I'm Gary Noll. We're 27 minutes into our program. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break. And when we come back from our break, we're going to go directly into this short 3-minute segment of Tucker Carlson talking about why would anyone defend the actions and behavior of MS-13, the most lethal gang in the world.
Officials and law enforcement yesterday, President Trump took a question about the gang MS-13. As he has before, the president expressed his thoughts on the subject bluntly.
We're taking people out of the country. You wouldn't believe how bad these people are. These aren't people. These are animals.
Well, if anything, that's a mild description. Dogs are animals, and a lot of them sleep on the bed. You wouldn't want to be anywhere near MS-13. They traffic in drugs, weapons, and human beings, young girls. Unlike animals, they kill for fun, often with machetes. They terrorize the poor and the vulnerable. They've made El Salvador the most dangerous country in the world. There is literally no defending them, and yet the left is defending them. Here's how the New York Times described what the president said, quote, Trump lashed out at undocumented immigrants during a White House meeting, calling those trying to breach the country's borders animals. Over at Jeff Bezos's vanity publication, The Washington Post, there was this, quote, Trump evokes an ugly history of dehumanization. So the president is a Nazi for criticizing a violent street gang. Newspapers haven't been this yellow since they started the Spanish-American War. For her part, over at the House, Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi raced to the nearest microphone to defend the dignity of MS-13. Watch this.
We're all God's children. There's a spark of divinity in every person on earth. And so when the president of the United States says about undocumented immigrants, these aren't people, these are animals. You have to wonder, does he not believe in the spark of divinity, the dignity and worth of every person? Every day that you think you've seen it all, along comes another manifestation of why their policies are so inhumane.
Well, that's not just dishonest, though obviously it is. It's lunatic. Why would the left be defending the country's most violent street gang? Trump has made them irrational. That's part of it. But the left also senses a threat to its most basic worldview. MS-13 is a living reminder that the left's position on immigration is fundamentally a lie. The media tell you every day that every immigrant, legal or not, is a future brain surgeon or tech company founder. Therefore, immigration controls are unnecessary. If they admit that MS-13 is actually bad and must be stopped, they'd have to also admit that when some countries send their people here, they aren't sending their best. A lot of immigrants are great, for sure. Some of them are rapists, though. Some join MS-13. That's just true. They're not all the same because people aren't all the same.
That's not the issue. The issue is not whether or not the people coming into this country, the vast majority of them seeking asylum here, are frequently coming because we, the United States, and our foreign policies of the war on drugs, for example, the exploitation of labor and the exploitation of resources in countries throughout Central and South America, from Colombia, Venezuela, we've created the environment where there is such inequality and destabilization within the society and such massive corruption by the people that we keep in power that there is going to be the emergence of gangs. As the gangs gain in their strength and power, the people who want to live a quality of life for themselves and their family are going to seek a safer place to be. And the United States is a lot safer. Now, granted, there must be a way to at least be able to qualify the people coming into the United States, but you have to include, why are they coming? Who are they? And what role did we have in precipitating this interest in coming here? That has to be a part of the discussion. Separate from that is, we have homegrown gangs, gangs that did not come from South America, Central America. They came from the ghettoization of America and cities. Because when a city is prosperous, when there's work, when there's an income, when there's a family, when the family is working together, when a person has a central meaning to their life and a community, keeping the community cohesive and working together as a part of that, you have far less crime. But when you have people looking at their mothers or fathers, if they have a mother and father, struggling, and then when they can't keep up with the bills, when they can't put food on the table, then they start putting some of that money into their veins, up their nose, into their lungs. And as a child, you see this, you feel helpless. As a young person, you can't change it. You can't change the system. You can't change the block you live on. You can't change the fact that people don't have work. And possibly your own mom, dad, or both. You get angry. You get resentful. Because you're also able to turn on television, go up on the internet, and see people from other neighborhoods, from neighborhoods that have public service, have good schools, that have safe streets, that are not starving, that are not eating one meal a day. You see that. What do you think about that? Because no one's coming into your neighborhood to correct anything. The only time you'll ever see a Clinton ever in your life is when they leave their gated communities with their armed bodyguards and their legions of suck-up, technocratic, best and brightest Harvard assholes. That's the only time you're ever going to see a Clinton, and yet you voted for him. Why? Because the left, in the most malicious contempt for anything representing honesty, has said, we're for you, unionist, black, Latino, migrant. And people want to believe that because they have nothing else they can believe in. The dire consequences of being poor in America have been simply erased from our consciousness. In one of the most Orwellian, unique propaganda campaigns, we focus upon the Cardassians. We focus upon those who are affluent. We focus upon the lifestyles of the rich and famous. We focus upon the latest fashions, the latest handbag, the latest cell phone for $1,000. We don't focus upon what it means to be 200 million Americans, to actually 230 million Americans who are at, above, or below the poverty level, who don't have $100 to their name. And so why don't you first ask, why does a person become a gang member? Why are they once in that gang? What is their purpose? What is the meaning of their life? It's not a healthy one. It's not a wholesome one. And yes, I absolutely agree with Nancy Pelosi. Every single person was born a pure spiritual being. Do they continue to act like it? Do they continue to show that I am a human being? I am not a rabid animal. I don't know of dogs, cats. I don't know of other primates. I don't know of other animals that actively go out to seek to bring harm to another human being. Therefore, it is misapplied to use the word acting like an animal. Being someone who's rescued and found homes and health and happiness for over 3,000 animals, I can tell you they act better than most human beings, more loyal, loving, kind. So we're misapplying words. We have to have a different syntax. We're also not acknowledging that, yes, everyone was a spiritual being, but then they were conditioned by circumstances, by epigenetics, by family, by peers, into becoming something either that honors that spirituality or dishonors it. If you dishonor what you were given, then you should be judged based upon the actions that you engage in. Can you redeem yourself? Absolutely. Should we be having places for people to be redeemed outside of a prison system that does not redeem anyone at any time for anything? Yes. We should have a completely new redemption center for people who have committed crimes against humanity. Ones where they can find a way back into life. That we have not put one penny into, but it costs us over $80,000 a year to incarcerate them and then treat them like rabid animals. So where is the contradiction when we don't say a word about how people are treated when they're incarcerated? But when they act out and when they tear the heart out of a human being and they butcher them with machetes and they laugh about it, when someone says you're acting like an animal or you're no better than an animal, we become extremely offended. I'm offended by our entire society, by our entire body politic, by the entire media. It's an offense against our intellect, against our spiritual nature, against morality, against common sense and reason. There can be no shame because they do not represent shame as a viable learning tool in their own lives. Yeah, shame on the left. You're an embarrassment. All you do is wrap yourself in slogans and euphemisms. And then you have the first black president. How did that work out? Was anything de-ghettoized? Did you open up the jails and stop the war on drugs? Did you reestablish humane ways of treating people who were poor, especially of color? Did you stop deporting people? Who deported more people than any president in American history? Barack Obama, over 4 million. Why is that not discussed? Because we're so immersed in the fraud of political dialogue that we forgot what it is just to be a human being who wants to make changes. So nothing that is in the public discourse do I accept as legitimate. Those are my thoughts. I'm going to give you a chance to share yours. Talk back. 888-874-4888. But before we get to that, I want to share a few thoughts, because I had the good fortune for a long time of being a research fellow at the Institute of Applied Biology. I was the director of anti-aging medicine, but I also was asked by the director of Trafalgar Hospital, would I help with their addiction program, which was not going well, nobody was getting over their addiction. I tried different processes and found one that worked, realizing that what was really causing their addiction was not the drugs per se, they were complementing it, but rather the dopamine hits. Now, I work with a lot of people in my life, and I'm finding, and have for a long time, that bringing a person back to minimalism, the austerity of the sacred, is the single most important thing I can do to help a person regain a sense of authenticity, of simplicity. That's why I've done my retreats for decades upon decades up in the woods. How many of you came up there? Over 10,000 came up over a 15-year period up in that little quaint area on that rustic farm, the Fertiller Farm. But you were close to nature. You could be out there seeing the bees and the deer, and you could put your hands in the soil and plant or harvest and go in and have a lunch from what you just picked. And you could be a part of the winter or spring, fall. You were close to nature, and more importantly, you were closer to your authentic self. And wherever else I've done it, it still is the same principle. You want to be in harmony with what allows you to feel good about yourself. But what we've done was we've removed ourselves from the natural simplicity of simple living, and we've created a very complicated life. For example, we will commute an hour and a half one way to a job we don't like, with a commute we don't like, listening to radio programs we don't like, and then going home and being uncomfortable where we're living because it's just transitory. It doesn't feel like a home should be. It's when we get more money that we'll build or buy or rent or lease another place. The whole object of this exercise is disingenuous. So what we're looking at today is people becoming addicted to their stuff, to the things in their life. And money is the number one way that we create addictive behavior. How so? Ask someone who gambles, why do they gamble? They know they're going to lose, but every time they win, they get a dopamine release. And when you can go and buy something, when you can fly first class, when you can fly on a private jet, when you can get invited to a screening, when you can walk a red carpet, when you suddenly have when you can afford a $700 bottle of vodka that just tastes like water anyhow, and anyone who says otherwise is an idiot, you can't tell the difference. But you know that you could afford $700 for a bottle of water, and it's called vodka, you get a dopamine hit. Why do people spend outrageous amounts of money for art's work that aren't even the artist's best work, and it's not worth that? Well, it's worth whatever someone's willing to pay for it. I'll tell you someday how I made my living for a long time so I could continue doing free counseling and free work and free radio show and all the other things I did for free. Is I would go to auctions, and I would sometimes go to 40 auctions before I buy something, and I buy something that would have value. And later on, I could sell that, and that would pay for 6 months or a year's worth of time I could donate for free. But then all that changed. I couldn't do that today because today it's all about egos, people who have a lot of money. And in that moment, when someone's saying, and who will bid this and who will bid that, going way beyond what the actual value of the object is that's being sold, someone will hold up a paddle so there'll be that dopamine hit. In this second, everyone's going to know that I can afford that. It doesn't seem reasonable, and it's not. But that's the power of what money can do. Just like cocaine, methamphetamine, alcohol, money, when you buy something with it, it creates this dopamine bonus. So then you look forward to other things that you can buy that will also stimulate your dopamine, and that creates the addictive link. Dopamine and money go hand in hand. The more money you have, the more things you can buy, possess, own, and the more you feel about that. I once was asked to take a meeting while I was doing a lecture for our sister station, KPFK in Los Angeles, and I had about 5 hours before the lecture and the premiere of a new film. So I went up into the Hollywood Hills, and there was this house. It was the strangest house I've ever seen. It was built in like where two pieces of the mountain come together in that crevice. It was like on 4 or 5 stories, and it was a gray-looking house, and it was just surreal inside. There was nothing comfortable about it, nothing aesthetically pleasing. And the man was asking me some health issues, and I answered him. And I turned to him as I was leaving. I said, "By the way, why did you build this place here?" He says, "To show people I could afford it." Okay. So something that's not aesthetically pleasing, that was very expensive to engineer it, to pass the codes, to be able to be in such a dangerous place. But just so you can say, "See that place up on the top where no one else would build? Well, I spent $28 million building a place there." The quality of it is irrelevant. The dopamine hit that lets everyone know that you could afford it is what gets you into parties, gets you into a place. And so we have whole addictive societies using money to get us through a day where everything is about spending and buying. Go down Rodeo Drive and ask people who are there. Just say, "How often do you come here?" And some people say, "Every week." Others, "Every day." "Why? Do you really need anything here?" "Oh, no." "Then why spend so much money on stuff that is so vastly overpriced?" That's the dopamine hit. So whatever we're doing, we become cash addicts. So we should put ahead of alcohol, ahead of sugar, ahead of cocaine and heroin, methamphetamine, we should put cash addiction. And even for the poorest of the poor, they also will find that when they spend their money, how often do, not all by any means, but how often do people buy something to get that hit? Where you don't have food, but you'll spend $400 on a new pair of sneakers. Why? That's that dopamine hit. Now we're going to hear 3 very sickening ways Americans are criminalizing being poor.
As if being homeless wasn't hard enough, there's now a growing trend of local laws across America turning homelessness into a criminal offense. Take, for instance, Bakersfield, California, where an aggressive ban on begging is set to take effect, making panhandling near businesses a misdemeanor. But the Bakersfield law is only one example of how communities are clamping down on homelessness. In the heart of Silicon Valley in Palo Alto, California, local lawmakers have enacted a law that actually bans sleeping in cars. That's right. Sleeping in something that you own could potentially lead you to 6 months in jail or a $1,000 fine under the argument that it damages the city's quality of life. And by city, I mean the 1%. Because depriving the poor of their last option for shelter certainly isn't protecting their quality of life. The end goal of these so-called quality of life laws is to make these cities practically impossible to live in for those who can't afford it. And what's worse is that these types of laws are expanding nationwide. According to a survey of 234 cities by the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty, 40% of the cities polled upheld bans on sleeping in public, 33% banned sitting, and upwards of 50% of cities have laws against panhandling. Wow, these stats paint a picture of an all-out legal assault on homelessness. But unfortunately, it doesn't stop there. In dozens of other towns, ordinances go as far as banning people from even helping the poor. For example, in Birmingham, Alabama, a Christian ministry is being blocked by police for handing out hot dogs and bottled water, citing the need to have a $500 permit to distribute food from a vehicle. The same is true in cities like Dallas, Philadelphia, and even New York City. In New York, a ban on food donations to homeless shelters is being justified because, get this, The city simply cannot assess the salt, fat, and fiber content in the food. Right. So, with corporate profits at a record high and income inequality in America growing faster than any other industrialized country, I have to ask, when did the war on poverty turn into a war against the poor? Joining me now to talk about just that, I'm joined by Eugene Puryear, organizer with the Answer Coalition, author of the book Shackled and Chained. Eugene, thank you so much for coming on.
No, thank you so much for having me, as always.
Eugene, I wanted to take a quick look at some of these headlines. U.S. poverty rises despite economic recovery. 4 out of 5 Americans face near poverty. That is insane. Why are we seeing this kind of downward trend after 50 years of fighting the so-called war on poverty?
Well, I think what we're seeing is really the results of the fact that, well, in general, capitalism is one of the the reality of it is, you know, there's only but so much wealth, and most of it goes to really rich people. But more immediately, we've seen that even the smaller steps taken, starting with the Johnson administration, the war on poverty, a 35-year assault on every social program, on unions, on pensions, wages that don't keep up with productivity. So essentially, even the smallest measures, just about every measure that helps mitigate poverty, has been taken away, while many, many measures that help enhance the wealth of the 1% of the few have been continually boosted forward by the government. So we've seen a greater immiseration of people.
I'm glad you mentioned benefits, because I wanted to take a look at this 2013 census supplemental poverty measure. Almost 50 million people in the U.S. are poor. Food stamps keeps 5 million people out of poverty. This is the most shocking. Without Social Security, more than half of Americans over 65 and over, would be in poverty. How much specifically is the assault on social services increasing this gap?
Oh, in a major way. I mean, we see that food stamps in just every budgetary cycle for the past 2 or 3 years has been one of the number one targets of Republicans, and that Democrats have connived in order to make these bargains and these deals to, you know, keep the budget going and all of that. They've caved on their principles, and they're continually agreeing to smaller than what's originally proposed reductions, but not being able to really step forward and fight for these programs. We see that they also, President Obama coming out for, or originally now, since it's an election year, he's changed his tactics so people will vote for the Democrats. But coming out for chain CPI and Social Security, which will ultimately lower people's benefits. So both parties are colluding around an agenda, which means reduced social services. And these social services are really a lifeline for people who aren't seeing any help from their wages and from their pensions, which are depressed.
They really are a lifeline. And what's amazing is that you don't really hear the GOP or Democratic Party, for instance, ever talking about the enormous amount of aid, hundreds of millions of dollars in aid given to dozens of countries around the world when we could. I mean, it's just a non-issue. The Social Security is a non-issue. I can't stress that enough. What do you think about all the measures that are being taken, as I just outlined, criminalizing the poor? I mean, not just neglecting them, straight up criminalizing it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's truly unbelievable in so many different ways, because every politician says they care about the poor. They say they care about the homeless. This is like the number one thing. But we see over and over again, whether it's food distribution, anything of that nature is being criminalized and being further put into channels that make it harder and harder for people to engage in mutual aid type solidarity. For people who, and this is sort of one of the quietest kept secrets of America, it's people who have more modest means who give the most money to charity. And so this is just a way to stop people into more direct control how people interact with each other, and that's something we're seeing on just about every level in this society, a greater curtailment, a panopticon from the NSA and others, and all sorts of things that make it much harder for us to interact as human beings, and much easier for the corporate, big business-controlled government to define what our lives are and what our values and the ideological frame of our society will be.
Yeah, well said. I mean, it just is really disturbing to have the middle class and even upper class say, we just don't want to see it. Mm-hmm. People in Silicon Valley, whatnot, not too many middle class in Silicon Valley, of course, but clearly there's something deeply wrong here. As I mentioned, corporate profits record high, income inequality growing faster than every other industrialized country. Disturbing. How can we address this beyond just superficial adjustments here? Because we're not seeing anything be done. In fact, it's getting worse.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we have to do a number of things. One, we have to really look at true living wages. $15 an hour, that's just one place to start. We live here in Washington, D.C. If you're a single mother, a living wage is $27 an hour.
Wow.
If the minimum wage had kept up to where it was in the mid-60s, it'd be something like $28 an hour.
Okay, let's just give you an idea that if you have an RV, if you have a van, if you have a car, and you don't have a home or apartment or any place to stay, in many areas in California, if they catch you sleeping in your car or van or RV, you could get a ticket, big fine. So much for the Golden State being a place that cares about people. Oh, by the way, 5 million people have left California in the last several years, because they cannot afford the rent or the taxes. There are other reasons to get out of there in any case. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.